Hello everyone, I'm Christopher Coker. I'm director of LSE Ideas, which is the main foreign policy think tank of the London School of Economics. And I'm very happy to welcome you to this series of lectures, and the very first in that series. It's run by our program, Global Strategies, which is headed by Hugh Sanderman. And the coordinator is Stuart Austin. So I'd like to thank them for their help in running this series and organizing this today. What we're aiming to do is to look at the reason why people haven't done strategy for the last 20 or 30 years, or why they've done it very badly. And we will have a series of talks. There'll be another one on the strategy, on strategic thinking of middle powers in Asia. With regard to China, there'll be one on Russian strategic thinking. There'll be one on urbanization in Africa. So we intend to be very wide in our range of subjects. The point today is that the world is a more dangerous place than it was 30 years ago. And the reason we think it's a more dangerous place is because of a lack of strategic vision. I give you an example of that. When President Obama was asked about his policy in Syria some years ago, what is our strategy on Syria? He actually said to a journalist, "We don't have a strategy." And he came back a week later and said, "We have a game plan." And his then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, in her memoirs, criticized him for saying that a game plan is not a strategy. You have to have an organizing principle. But when she herself was competing for the election in 2016, she didn't have a strategy either, which is one of the reasons she lost the election. She had a slogan called Stronger Together, but it wasn't as appealing as America First or America Great Again, which was the strategy of Donald Trump. However, when Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was one of the last great strategic thinkers in the United States, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times, actually the week before he died, he said that Make America Great Again is a wonderful bumper sticker for your car, but it is not actually a strategy. So I think we've all faced, particularly in the Western world, the problem that we don't do strategic thinking. And can we bring strategy back in? So this afternoon, we have an excellent speaker, Matthew Cronin, who is director of the Global Strategy Initiative and deputy director of the Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. And he will say something about General Scowcroft, who I think was one of the last of the old strategic thinkers in the United States. He's a professor of government and foreign service at Georgetown University. And he has excellent policy experience. He was in the Pentagon's strategy office and the CIA's strategic assessment group. And he's the author of seven books, including the most recent one published by Oxford University Press, The Return of Great Power Rivalry. Let me just tell you what the format of this series is. Our speaker will speak for about 30 to 35 minutes, and then I will interrogate him, if that's the right word, for another 20 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the Q&A session. And the reason why we have this format is that we hope it will produce more structure to the actual conversation. So, Matt, over to you.
Great. Well, thank you very much for that introduction, Professor Coker. It's really an honor to be here. I wish I could be in London joining you in person, but this is the next best thing. Thank you very much to LSE Ideas for hosting this debate series. I think it's an excellent initiative. I'm honored to be selected for the series and very much look forward to the subsequent lectures from my colleagues. So the question before us today is, can the United States effectively formulate and practice a national strategy? And there is a lot of pessimism on this question currently. People say the United States is too polarized, its democracy is dysfunctional, short-sighted, focused on the next election, unable to plan for the long term. And the United States is a declining power relative to China and others. And so for all of these reasons, it's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for the United States to formulate an effective strategy. And so I'm going to argue against this today and argue that there are severe challenges indeed, but that the United States has been an effective strategic planner and executor in the past, and that it can once again have an effective strategy for the challenges we face today. So I want to do this in four parts. First, I'm going to talk about the challenges facing the United States and its allies currently. Second, I want to look to the past for a model of effective strategic thinking in U.S. history, and I will turn to General Scowcroft, the namesake of the Scowcroft Center that I helped to manage. Third, I want to talk about how one would go about putting together an effective strategy today, the methodology of strategy, but also what that strategy should look like. And then fourth and finally, I'll talk about some of the obstacles to effective strategic planning and how the United States and its allies can overcome these obstacles to revitalize and adapt their role for this new era. So first, what is the contemporary challenge? And I think it's helpful to put this in a historic perspective because I think the United States and its allies have been quite successful over the past 75 years. In fact, my colleague, Walter Russell Mead, who writes for the Wall Street Journal, once said that the United States has effectively had a three-part grand strategy over the past three quarters of a century. It's been first to build a rules-based international system focused on alliances, promotion of open markets at home and abroad, promotion, however imperfectly, of democracy, freedom, and good governance. Second, it's to invite other countries to join that system, and even former adversaries like Germany and Japan, if they're willing to play by the rules, can be part of this system. And then third and finally, the United States and its allies have defended this system from challengers, from the Soviet Union during the Cold War, rogue states and terrorists after the end of the Cold War, and today, major challenge comes from great power, revisionist autocrats like Russia and China. And so what has been the effect of, it may not be a strategy per se, but a broad approach to the world over the past 75 years. And I think the United States and its allies in the world are better off today than they were in 1945, 75 years without great power war, a number of people dying in armed conflict much lower today than at any point in world history prior to 1945. Levels of economic development. Global GDP per capita is triple today what it was in the 1940s. Number of people living in poverty in the 1940s was 66% of the global population. Today it's 10%. And number of people living under democratic governments in the 1940s, it was only 17 countries in the world were democracies. Today it's 96. So in short, I think the world is much safer, more prosperous and freer today than it was really at any point in world history prior to 1945. And I do think the United States and its democratic allies and the world we've built is a major part of that success. So to sure, there have been challenges and mistakes, Vietnam War, Iraq, Afghanistan, and others. But overall, I think this has been a successful approach to the world. But this system is being challenged, and there are a lot of challenges facing the United States and its allies today, and I'll break these down into the external and internal challenges. So externally, we have disruptive technology, artificial intelligence, quantum computing, additive manufacturing, many other emerging technologies that will fundamentally change economies and societies, but will also have implications for national security. And can the United States and its allies win this new tech arms race, or will China and others gain the advantage in 21st century technologies? Climate change, of course, is a serious challenge along with nuclear war. The only real threat that if left unaddressed over the long term could result in even human extinction. The challenge from rogue states, Iran and North Korea, pursuing nuclear and missile programs. Iran, the world's leading state sponsor of terror, and terrorism, even though Al-Qaeda and ISIS are not as strong as they used to be, they continue to operate, and the ideas and the conditions that helped them to rise in the past could reemerge in the future. But the biggest challenge facing the United States and its allies, as I mentioned before, is the renewal of great power competition with Russia and China, but especially with China. China has grown at rapid rates over the past several decades, is now the world's second largest economy. Economists project that China could overtake the United States as the world's largest economy within the decade. This would be the first time a country other than the United States was the world's leading economy since the 1890s. China's using that economic power to increase its diplomatic and military influence. It's increasing its diplomatic influence in the UN organizations, every region on Earth, and investing in military capabilities. It's greatly shifted the balance of power in Asia, and many U.S. defense planners question whether the United States still has the ability to defend longstanding allies and partners like Taiwan in the event of a major war with China. So while these other challenges threaten to disrupt this U.S.-led system, I think China is really the only threat on Earth that threatens to displace this system. And I do think that's the Chinese goal, to have everything that the United States has had for the past 75 years and reorder international politics in a way that better suits Beijing. So this is a serious challenge. But some of the most serious challenges aren't coming from without the United States, they're coming from within. Questions about public support and for the United States' traditional international leadership role. We saw the rise of populism in the election of President Donald Trump, where many American voters seem to say that they're not sure they want the United States engaged in the world, supporting traditional alliances, supporting free trade. And so is this a sign that the United States is pulling back from its traditional international leadership role? And it wasn't just with President Trump. If we'll remember, President Obama also talked about how the United States should step back and other countries will step up. Also, there's a lack of confidence, I think, in the U.S. Model, in democracy and capitalism, which has served us so well over the centuries, certainly in recent decades. But many question, is this the best way to structure domestic politics and economics? Or are there other models like China's state-led capitalist model, more state involvement in strategic planning in the economy, industrial policy? Is that a better way to structure domestic economies and societies? And certainly we see many dictators around the world who find the Chinese model more attractive, if for no other reason than it gives them a pretext for maintaining strict autocratic control of their countries. So this is a pretty serious challenge to what the United States and its allies have built over the past several decades. So this brings me to the second part of the talk. And can we look back to history for examples of strategists in the past who have successfully navigated such inflection points? And so here I want to talk about General Scowcroft, because if you look at U.S. national security policy, national security strategy since the end of the Cold War, I think there have been three major inflection points. So first, there was the transition to the end of World War II, to the beginning of the Cold War era. And I think there were many American strategists who got that one right, including Truman, Acheson, and others. And the United States, of course, was helped in that transition with leading allies such as Great Britain. The second major transition was the transition from the end of the Cold War to the post-Cold War world. And then the third is the one we're at today, the end of the post-Cold War world, the end of this period of unchallenged U.S. preeminence, and the beginning of something new. We can call it this new era of great power competition with China. So I want to look at the second period because I do think that General Scowcroft deserves a lot of credit from the successful transition from the end of the Cold War and the beginning of the post-Cold War world. General Scowcroft, the only person to serve as national security advisor to two U.S. presidents, President Ford, and then also President George H.W. Bush at the end of the Cold War. In a way, he served three presidents because he was deputy national security advisor to Nixon when Kissinger was dual-hatted as national security advisor and secretary of state. So as Kissinger was spending a lot of time in Foggy Bottom, Scowcroft was really running things at the White House. And Scowcroft is often seen as the best U.S. national security advisor in history. And so at the Scowcroft Center, we try to honor his legacy. And I think he was an effective strategic thinker. In fact, when the Scowcroft Center was stood up, he told us that there are a lot of think tanks around town and around the world focusing on the day-to-day policy issues, too few that take a step back and look at real strategy. And that's going to be the mission of the Scowcroft Center, to do real strategic thinking. And so talking to people who have worked with Scowcroft, they said whenever you briefed him when he was national security advisor, you'd come in to talk about breaking news or to recommend some new policy. His first question was almost always, wait a second, what is the strategy? What is the strategy? To not start with what just happened or with the recommendation, but to take a step back, remind everyone of the strategic framework the United States was pursuing, and then interpret the new events in light of the strategy. It's possible this new development can help us to advance our strategy. It's also possible that it would cause us to set our strategy back or even cause the United States to reevaluate its strategy. And one of the things that Scowcroft said is if you only react to crises, you often only get more crises, that you can't just react to what's happening, can't just respond to your inbox. You have to have a vision of where you're going and then harness events to bring you to that vision. And so I think Scowcroft's constant focus on strategy proved to be successful. He's credited with putting in place the modern national security advisor position and process that has been emulated by all of his predecessors. And as we'll discuss in a moment, I think organizing for strategy and having a method is important. But also, if you look at his substantive accomplishments as national security advisor for the first President Bush, He helped to end the Cold War without firing a shot, built an international coalition to evict Saddam Hussein from Kuwait, so working closely with allies and partners to push back against this autocratic revisionism and territorial aggrandizement as part of building this new world order after the end of the Cold War. But he also thought it was important to maintain engagement even with rivals. So right after the Tiananmen Square crackdown, General Scowcroft traveled to Beijing and met with Chinese leaders and expressed his concern about Tiananmen, but also wanted to make sure the relationship stayed on a stable footing. And Scowcroft was widely criticized for that, but thought that an engagement track among the great powers was important. So I think Scowcroft's model can inspire us as we think about this transition of this new inflection point from the post-Cold War world that he helped build, turning back into this new era of a more competitive security environment. And so this brings me to the third part of the talk, maybe the most important part of the talk: how can we put together a strategy for this current environment? So I want to talk about the method of strategy. And at the Scowcroft Center, we publish a series of strategy papers, and all of our papers follow a strict template. And Steve Hadley, former national security advisor, a protege of General Scowcroft and an advisor to the Scowcroft Center, advises us to follow this template slavishly. So I'll talk about the template for strategy, highlighting some key components of strategic planning. And I'll do that with an example. One of our strategy papers recently was called Present at the Recreation, Strategy for Revitalizing, Adapting, and Defending a U.S.-led Rules-Based System. And I think that a lot of what we wrote about in the strategy we can see reflected now in what may be the Biden administration's emerging strategy. I think we'll see some similar themes. So the first part of a good strategy is understanding the strategic context. What are the challenges and opportunities in the security environment that the strategy needs to respond to? And so we've already discussed many of those already in this lecture: disruptive technology, the rise of China, and other challenges. But also, as the hockey legend Wayne Gretzky said, you don't want to skate to where the puck is, you want to skate to where the puck is going. And good strategy should remain in place for years, if not longer. And so where is the international security environment heading, and how can we plan for that? Of course, we don't have a crystal ball. We don't know for sure And so there are a number of strategic foresight methods, including scenario planning, that can help us to do that. And looking ahead to the future today, I see a couple of plausible scenarios. One is a new Cold War with China, which I think is undesirable, but maybe where we're headed. Another one could be the breakdown of this US-led rules-based system and nothing really to replace it. So an extended period of disorder and competition. I think a third scenario would be that the United States and its democratic allies revitalize and adapt this rules-based system for a new era. And I think that this would be the most desirable of these three scenarios and what a good strategy should be aimed at doing. So understanding the strategic context. Next, what are the goals of the strategy? Scowcroft said that conceptually, strategy is simple. It's about having a clearly articulated set of goals and having a story about how you're going to achieve those goals. So he said, conceptually, it's simple. In practice, doing strategy is difficult. And I think that's right. And I even think that this step, articulating the goals, is difficult for many people. And it's something I've seen editing these strategy papers. Even many national security professionals, they're quite good at identifying the strategic context and the challenges. They're quite good at making recommendations about what the United States and its allies should do about it. But they often skip over that key step. What is it we're trying to accomplish? What are the goals? If you don't have goals, you know, any path can, if you don't know where you're going, any path can get you there. So I think articulating the goals is important. And I think many of the goals for U.S. national strategies, including in the present era, can essentially be traced back to the Declaration of Independence. In the Declaration of Independence, we said we wanted life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So life roughly corresponding to security, liberty to democracy, freedom, good governance, human rights, and pursuit of happiness, different ways to define that, but hard, I think, to pursue happiness in poverty, and so some level of prosperity. And so I think a good U.S. Strategy should aim to produce security, prosperity, and freedom for the American people. And then enlightened self-interest, I think the United States is better off if much of the rest of the world, especially important geopolitical regions like the Middle East and Europe and the Indo-Pacific, also have security, prosperity, and to the degree possible, democracy, freedom, and good governance. So those are the goals. Next major part of a good strategy are the elements of the strategy. What are the 3 to 5 major lines of effort that are going to help the United States to achieve those goals? So not just a laundry list of a bunch of actions that can be taken, not just one or two major lines of effort, but I think, you know, what are the several lines of effort that can help you to organize the government, society, allies to help you achieve those goals. In this strategy paper I mentioned, Present at the Recreation, we essentially say that it's not 1945 anymore, it's not 1991 anymore. The United States needs to adapt its strategy for a new era. But the basic outlines of what it's done over the past 75 years has been largely successful, and so we don't want to throw that away. And so the goal should be to revitalize and adapt the system for a new era, and then defend the system from challenges. So these are the 3 elements, revitalize, adapt, and defend. So let me just say a few words about each of these. So first, revitalize. I think there are parts of the system that the United States and its allies have put in place that can continue to work, but that they need to be strengthened for this new era of competition. After all, if you think about many competitions, athletic events, it's not so much about pulling down your competitor, it's about making yourself as fit as possible. And so I think the United States and its allies can do more to make ourselves fit, strengthening ourselves at home, investing in infrastructure and new technology, strengthening our alliances, recommitting to our alliances, recommitting to some of the multilateral institutions that we've maybe paid inadequate attention to and have allowed China to claim leadership roles. and continue to do the things that have worked for us over the past 75 years, promote our model, free markets, and democracy is the best way to structure domestic societies, politics, and economics. Second, we need to adapt this system for a new era. Again, it's not 1945, it's not 1991. What needs to change for where we are today? And I do think this cleavage between democracies and autocracies is a central cleavage in the current international system. It's one that President Biden has talked a lot about. And so I think we need to adapt along two tracks. One is for the United States and like-minded democracies to find new fora for deeper collaboration and forge common solutions to common challenges, including creating new institutions. And Boris Johnson has talked about turning the G7 into a D10. I think that is the kind of thing that could make sense in this category, bring together more like-minded democracies from places like the Indo-Pacific that are becoming increasingly strategically important. But the other track, I think, is for engagement, more inclusive fora where we can engage with adversaries like Russia and China. And I'm not naive. I don't think that the kind of meeting with Putin today or an engagement track with China is going to lead to any major immediate breakthroughs, but I think it's important for several reasons. One, there is the possibility that we can find cooperation on certain practical areas, maybe arms control, maybe climate change. But most importantly, I think over the long run, if a revitalized US-led rules-based system is going to work, ideally we would like China and Russia to be a part of that system, or at least acquiesce to that system and not actively try to tear it down. Difficult to have a functioning a global rules-based system if the world's second largest economy, second largest military is resisting it. So I don't think it's easy, but I think over time we should try to convince the next generation of Chinese leadership, the next generation of Russian leadership, that challenging the United States and its allies is too difficult and costly, and that Beijing and Moscow may be better off pursuing a more cooperative approach. So again, I don't think it will be easy. It can be accomplished in the near term, but I think that should be part of the objective of this engagement track. Third and finally is defend. And I think this may be among the most important. The system is being challenged by Russia, China, Iran, North Korea. But I think the China challenge is especially important. So I think the United States and its allies need to work together to defend against the real challenges that China poses in the economic, governance, military domain, and impose significant costs on the Chinese Communist Party when it engages in this behavior that threatens us and that challenges widely held international norms, to defend ourselves, but then also to convince the Chinese leadership, the Russian leadership, that challenging the United States and its allies, again, is too difficult and too costly. And they'd better off pursuing a different approach. Okay, this brings me to the final part of my talk. The difficulty of strategy today. So this might sound like a good plan. We want peace, prosperity, and freedom. We're going to do that by strengthening ourselves, finding new ways for engaging with our partners and with the adversary and defending against the threats that the adversary poses. But how can we do that? And I think there are real challenges to practicing strategy today. So one that you often hear is, does the United States still have the ability or the willingness to lead? And it's a good question. But I do think that the United States ultimately still does have the ability and the willingness to lead. So people rightly focus on polarization within US domestic politics. But I think there still is, often doesn't get reported, but I still think there is a broad bipartisan consensus on some of the most important elements of U.S. national security strategy. And I think that consensus is broadening and deepening because of the China challenge. There is a real recognition throughout Washington that this is the foremost challenge facing the United States and its allies. If you look at U.S. public opinion polling, there still is a deep reservoir of support for U.S. global engagement. Support for alliances, free trade, U.S. leadership remains high. Another challenge with practicing strategy today is organizing. In the past, during the Cold War, the United States used to talk about the challenges of a whole of government strategy. How do you get the State Department, Defense Department, CIA, White House all pulling in the same direction? That's difficult in and of itself. But today, I think you could argue that really you need a whole of society strategy. You know, how do you get big technology firms on board with the technology challenge posed by China? That's difficult. And in a way, it's a whole of free world strategy is what's required. Because if the United States is taking certain steps, say to deny sensitive technology to China, but China just goes to Germany and Japan to get that technology, then it's not a very good strategy. So we really need a whole of society, whole of free world approach. And so that's certainly going to be challenging, but I do think there are some reasons to believe that this is possible. So technology companies are increasingly understanding the challenges that China poses. The United States has begun to put in place some smart legislation and policies forcing companies to engage in a selective decoupling from China in some of the most sensitive areas. And U.S. allies, I think, are also awakening to the China challenge. We see this clearly with the Quad in Asia. But even the G7 communique from this weekend stating that China is a major challenge to the free world and to Europe. Finally, capacity. Do the United States and its allies have the capacity to execute this strategy? You know, many would say that we're declining powers, that China is the rising power, that even if we want to do something like this, we simply don't have what it takes. And I would also argue that that is incorrect. If you look at share of global GDP, one of the best measures of power often used by IR scholars, it's not actually the case that the United States is declining. The United States has had between 20 and 25% of global GDP since the 1960s. And that's where it is currently, at about 22 or 23% of global GDP. So the United States is not declining. It's a relative decline. It is true that China is rising. But then you put U.S. Allies into the mix. U.S. formal treaty allies make up roughly 60% of global GDP. So compared to China's 17 or 18%, we're still possess a preponderance of power that I think allows us to decisively shape outcomes. If the United States, the Europeans, and the Japanese can agree on trade standards or technology standards, for example, it's going to be very difficult for China to write the rules. So I believe I'm coming to the end of my time, so I think I'll just wrap up by saying there is a lot of pessimism, but if we look over the past 75 years, I think there's good reason for optimism. The United States and its allies have thrived over the past 75 years, dealt with serious challenges like from the Soviet Union in the past, but have always emerged successfully from these challenges. They've made their own people and the world a richer, safer, and freer place. And this is a serious challenge, the full array of challenges, but especially the challenge from China. But I think by working together, by learning the lessons from those who have done this successfully in the past, including General Scowcroft, that we can successfully revitalize, adapt, and defend the U.S.-led system for a new era, and with any luck, provide the world and our populations another 75 years of peace, prosperity, and freedom. So I'll end my remarks there and very much look forward to the discussion and Q&A.
Thank you very much, Matt. A lot of food for thought there. My job is to not interrogate you, but it is to come back on some of the points you've made and ask you to clarify them or defend them. So can I start, first of all, with strategy, the very concept? And you mentioned means ends at one point, that you set yourself certain goals and objectives, and you have to make sure that you have the means to achieve those objectives. And one of the arguments would be made, and it was made by a Republican, Robert Gates, who was the defense secretary, of course, Republican, but he was in Obama's administration, in an interview he gave with the Wall Street Journal, in which he said that he was very critical of the administration which he served, particularly on Syria. And this is the point I want to make, is that we set ourselves a goal, Assad must go, but we hadn't a clue how to actually make him go. And ultimately, there was only one person who could make him go, and that was Vladimir Putin, who could make a phone call and probably get him to go, probably. But even Vladimir Putin might not have been able to have done that. But we certainly couldn't do that with a phone call. So we had no idea of how to achieve what we set out in the Security Council when our ambassador said he had to go. So it's called, as you know very well, a blue sky objective. Don't set yourself blue sky objectives if you can't achieve those things. The bigger question I want to ask you is, surely the United States is no longer a superpower. I mean, this is, and it is very unhelpful to talk about superpowers in this. The world is too complex for superpowers. China perhaps is on the way to becoming a superpower. It's a long way away from that, if it does. But the United States is no longer a superpower. You use the word decline a lot. And I would say that you're probably right. The United States is not declining, but it's no longer a superpower. And the beginning of wisdom is to accept that it is now the greatest of the great powers. But within that reality, it has to accept certain givens. And that's not always the case with American administrations, be it Trump or Biden. But you may well disagree and say the United States is a superpower and can set itself these kind of, I'm not saying blue sky objectives, but it can set itself very ambitious goals.
Yes, rich set of comments. So let me respond to a few points. One, Secretary Gates, I have a lot of respect for Secretary Gates. In fact, he was deputy national security advisor to Scowcroft when Scowcroft was national security advisor in the George H.W. Bush administration. And I think part of the credit for Scowcroft's success goes to Gates, because deputy national security advisor in the U.S. system is arguably a more challenging position than national security advisor, because you're really coordinating the various U.S. Government bodies and the interagency process and deputies committee meetings and the like. So I think you're absolutely, you know, so I talked about the success of U.S. strategy overall over the past 75 years, but of course there have been notable failures, and I think Syria is a good example of that. I think you know, we can think of many others. And I think part of the problem with Syria, I think, is that the administration spoke before it had a strategy. And I think this is a key of good strategy. Think about what your goals are. You know, what is the strategy? And then articulate that. But it's much harder to you know, say things and then try to formulate a strategy around what you've already said. And I think that is a fair criticism of the Obama administration, that often they focus too much on the public relations and having a quick statement to every breaking event, rather than taking a step back and asking what is the strategy. And I think this goes back to Scowcroft's point of, don't just react to the crisis. You know, first take a step back and say, how does this fit to our strategy? So on objectives, I think you're you know, also correct. It has to be a realistic objective. And I think if you look at many of the U.S. Failures over the years, including, say, Iraq or Vietnam, you know, it was really a combination of, I think, three problems. One was a very difficult to achieve objective, if not an impossible objective, in a situation where actually the achieving that objective would have been pretty, insignificant. Not even success isn't something that was going to drastically improve the U.S. position, or failure wasn't going to drastically harm the U.S. position. And then also devoting pretty significant resources. So devoting a lot of resources to something that's fairly insignificant, where the goal is arguably impossible. And so I think those are the types of actions the United States would be well advised to avoid in the future. And going back to Secretary Gates, famously said that if any U.S. president wants to get into a ground war in Asia, he or she should have their head examined. The United States is no longer a superpower. I think it depends on how superpower is defined. I think you're right. It's not the 1990s. This is a much more competitive system. China, I think, is a competitive great power. I think Russia qualifies as a competitive great power as well, even though its economy is small. It does have other ways to cause serious damage to the United States and its allies. But I do think the United States is still the leading state in the international system, the first among equals, perhaps, does have enormous strengths, still has the world's largest economy, center of the global financial system, 30 formal treaty allies that make up 60% of global GDP, the world's only superpower military, I would say. When we talk about conflict with Russia and China, it's talking about a conflict on their borders. You know, we're not worried about Russia or China invading North America anytime soon. So it depends on how you define superpower. I think there are other great powers. It is more competitive, but that the United States is the first among equals.
Okay, well, let me take you up on that point. And you can well make the argument, but as far as the Biden administration is concerned, and indeed even the Trump administration, not necessarily President Trump himself, but certainly his administration, Russia is a suboptimal strategic player. It's not a great power. It's a regional power. The conversation that Biden had on the phone with President Putin over the military buildup on Ukraine, whatever was actually said, but you know the what we've told was actually said, which was butt out essentially, and there will be terrible repercussions if you actually even think of any military engagement here. That's the kind of conversation you cannot have with China, but you can have with Russia. The question I think I have here is, China is a country that the United States has never faced before. It's not Imperial Japan. It's not Nazi Germany. It's not Germany in 1914. It is obviously qualitatively a very different power. And the Chinese will say, we were the number one power, of course, in the world for 700 years, and then we disappeared off the radar screen for a few centuries, and now we're back. Now, whether you buy into that or not, I think in terms of just the STEM subjects, for example, where the Chinese now have this enormous advantage because a quarter of people involved in research are Chinese, and that the percentages get greater. It's a kind of power that the US has never faced before. How does the United States deal with that reality? Because it is always because of American exceptionalism since the 1869 when it overtook the British economy. So we're told by historians, possibly even earlier than that, it's never had to deal with a country like that before.
Yes, you're right. I think China is perhaps the most serious challenge state-based competitor the United States has ever faced. You know, even the Soviet Union never had as a share of GDP as close to what China has compared to the United States currently. And so I think this is why the United States sees this so seriously. My colleague Tom Wright wrote in The Atlantic a week or so ago that he thinks there is an emerging Biden doctrine. It's that this is an era of democracies versus autocracies, but this time the democracies might lose. And so I think there is a recognition that China is a serious challenge. I've talked about some of those economically, militarily, politically. On the other hand, and this is a point I maybe should have made in my talk, I think often good strategy comes from thinking about where are we strong and where is the adversary weak? Because I often think national security analysts, people in the national security community, tend to do the reverse, which makes sense. They focus on their own weaknesses and the adversary's strengths. And again, that makes sense. Where are the threats? Where are we vulnerable? But I often think good strategy comes from the reverse. Where are we strong? Where are they weak? And how can we stick it to them there? And the Chinese have significant vulnerabilities. And I think a lot of them do stem from this autocratic model. So they're not Imperial Japan or Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union, I think they do have a lot of the same weaknesses we've seen in autocratic challengers in the past. And in fact, I published a book last year called The Return of Great Power Rivalry, mm-hmm. Democracy versus Autocracy from the Ancient World to the US and China, where I make some of these points. But I think President Xi is prioritizing political control over economic performance. We can see that most clearly in Hong Kong, where he's hurting Hong Kong's economic performance, but he wants to tamp down on any threats to his rule there. Diplomatically, I think China's overplaying its hand with some of its wolf warrior diplomacy, sanctioning European officials. And we see that anti-Chinese sentiment is at all-time highs around the world. And then militarily, I think there too, that China's autocratic system is limiting China's military potential. And just best example of this, dictators often fear their own people more than the enemy. And China's spending more on internal security than it is on its military, where the United States is 2-1 in the other direction. So I think that China is a serious competitor. I think that world war, a major war with China is a possibility that the United States might very well lose. So I don't want to downplay it at all. But I think we also need to recognize that we have considerable strengths. China has considerable weaknesses, and we need to use those to our advantage as we formulate an effective strategy.
When I was saying that the China is a society of the kind of which the United States has never had to deal, and I was actually quoting or echoing a paper that was written in 1908 by a cabinet official about Germany, that Germany was the most extraordinary power that the United Kingdom had ever had to face because of its technological ability, its scientific ability, etc. The other power, of course, the United Kingdom had to face in 1900 was the United States. And we avoided a war. If you go back to the idea of the Thucydidean trap, that a declining power or a status quo power, it doesn't have to be declining, faces a rising power, and it always ends in war. In the case, as you know, this argument of 16 countries that the Harvard professor, I've forgotten his name now, you know who I mean.
Graham Allison.
Yes, Graham Allison, was saying there were two exceptions to that. I've forgotten what the second one is, but the first was the United Kingdom and the United States. But the reason for that was, I think, the United Kingdom told itself a story that it came to believe, and still telling itself the story today when it talks about special relationships, that we're on the same side, you know, we're on the same relay team, like an Olympic race. And it doesn't actually matter who passes the ticker tape first. We're on the same team, so we get a gold medal. Now, what story can the United States tell itself about being overtaken by China, if you think that that is the case? Because if you want to avoid war between the two countries, the Thucydidean trap would suggest you have to have what academics call a reference narrative. You have to have a story that is believable. Now, one of the believable stories in the Cold War, which the United States and the Soviet Union both told each other, was that they were going to win historically because of the internal contradictions of capitalism and communism. So all they had to do was avoid a nuclear war and let history take its course. And that's not a I just don't think that there is a common reference narrative or story that the United States and China can tell about each other. And that's, I think, is the most worrying thing at the moment. And then I would like to ask you another question, which is, why is the United States not willing to share with China? It's the inevitable. You've got actually everything you wanted from China 50 years ago. It turned from a resentful communist state into a proto-capitalist state. It's now the main one of the main charges of capitalism. It's a country which basically, you know, has bought into the international system, which wasn't the case under Mao Zedong. You've got actually the China you wanted. It just happens to be terribly successful, too successful than you actually imagined. What is the problem here?
Good, good question. So first, on the Thucydides trap, I think you're right that it's very hard to imagine a transition between a declining United States and a rising China going smoothly. And I think we're already seeing the tensions in that relationship. So I think the goal for the United States should not be to peacefully pass the baton to China, but rather to prevent the transition from happening, not by keeping China down, but by helping the United States to continue to innovate, to grow its economy, to build its alliances, to stay stronger. And then we'll never have to, with good strategy and a little bit of luck, might not have to face this question of what a Chinese-led system looks like. And I think, you know, some people might think that's unrealistic, but I really don't. I don't think we have a lot of evidence of these state-led economies, autocratic systems, performing well over the long term. So I do think there's a significant possibility that the Chinese model runs out of steam, that the United States and its democratic allies rejuvenate themselves and maintain the leadership position, and this transition never takes place. On why isn't the United States willing to share with China? I think this was a big mistake by President Xi. I think that China had a good thing going in the 1990s and in the 2000s. You know, the United States and its allies really hoped that China would become a responsible stakeholder. And so we are willing to turn a blind eye at China's unfair trade practices because we had this hope that as China became richer, it would become more cooperative, more democratic. And I think the China you described was basically accurate in the 90s, the 2000s. It had become part of the international system. It was successful. But I think President Xi has really put China on a different trajectory. And my colleague at Stanford, Elizabeth Economy, wrote a good book called The Third Revolution, where she says there are three revolutions in recent Chinese history: the Mao's revolution, the Deng Xiaoping revolution that really laid the groundwork for China's success, and now Xi's revolution of essentially saying Deng's strategy of hiding capabilities and biding time is over. It's time for China's coming out party. We're ready to challenge the United States and the world. And I think that was a mistake on Xi's part. I think if he had stuck to Deng's strategy, the United States and its allies would likely be going about our business now, allowing China to continue to rise. But when we saw that things weren't going as we'd hoped, that instead of becoming more cooperative, China was becoming more aggressive, we've decided, okay, the strategy for the past 25 years has failed. We can no longer turn a blind eye to genocide in Xinjiang, to the systematic cheating on the global economic system, to China's disputes, territorial disputes with its neighbors, militarily threatening several of its neighbors. So now the time is needed for a tougher strategy. So I would say the United States is willing to share. It's China that's causing the current confrontation.
Mm. But then, of course, if you were Chinese, you might actually say that the country that is actually most disruptive is the United States, and has been in the last few years. So I'm thinking of a book by Kishore Mahbubani, former Singaporean ambassador to the United Nations, who wrote a book, Has the West Lost It? And the reason he asked that question is that he thought the West had actually lost the plot. So it claimed to be trying to manage the international liberal order, rules-based order, whatever you call it, but it kept breaking the rules whenever it suited it. So whether it was the Iran agreement under Trump, which took years and years to actually negotiate, just broken by a president overnight, or the Paris Accords, which also took a hell of a long time to actually negotiate. Or you can go back to President Bush in the beginning of the war in Iraq, where he was asked by journalists, do we have international law on our side? And he famously said, oops, I haven't thought about that. Let me call my lawyer and find out. You know, that kind of joke, which no American president can make now. And that is the difference, the reality now. With the unipolar moment, of course, back in 2003, things have changed. The Chinese would say, look, who's actually breaking all this liberal world rules-based order that you keep talking about? And you want us to be a stakeholder in, of course. It's you. How would you respond to that?
Well, good. I think it is the case that the United States has sometimes broken its own rules. And I think a couple of things I would say to that. I think occasionally system management, even a rules-based system, requires breaking the rules to make it work. Now, of course, that can't be the normal pattern. But I think it is sometimes required. If a rogue state is pursuing WMD or engaging in terrorism, and the existing rules, say the UN Security Council, doesn't provide a legal basis to respond. I do think that countries should still, especially leading countries like the United States, need to take action to uphold international security. But the other thing I would say is that I do think the United States has too often done this. It would be much better if we do things according to the rules. And you know, I think some of the time, the Iran nuclear agreement, I think the problem there wasn't pulling out, but signing the agreement in the first place, because really the agreement was contrary to the standard rules of U.S. nonproliferation policy. Going back to Eisenhower, we'd always tried to stop the spread of enrichment technology, reprocessing technology to other countries, including our own allies. And so the Iran nuclear deal essentially created this huge exception, not for a friend, but for a country that's the largest state sponsor of terror that had repeatedly reneged on its commitments. So, you know, having a rules-based order doesn't always mean that agreements or rules are better. I think sometimes we are better off without an agreement. And the Iran deal is a case in point. Final thing I'd say is that if you want to just look at the record of who's breaking more rules, the United States or China, there's no comparison. China's engaging in a genocide against its own people, systematically cheating on the international trading system. Yes, the United States has made some mistakes in the past, but I think it doesn't compare at all to China's systematic efforts to really undermine this US-led system.
But we have a similar discussion in the United Kingdom about breaking the rules. We have a government that has decided to break international law by ignoring the treaties actually signed with the European Union on Northern Ireland. And the Attorney General did actually say in the House of Commons that will be actually breaking international law. So we have a Western government which is breaking international law, an agreement that is actually signed. Not a good, I think, example to set if you're trying to make a point. But I realize that that's not an issue for you. So let me go back to Scowcroft. And I did have the great advantage of meeting General Scowcroft many, many years ago. And he's obviously an extraordinary figure. So the question I have to say is, are these figures of the past? And when you're looking at Brzezinski, who I mentioned in my introduction, and you're looking at Henry Kissinger, and even if you go back to the old nuclear age wizards like Brody and Schelling and all of those, you're dealing with a different, I would say, class of person. You're dealing with people who are actually intellectually very, very strong. Or whether you agree with how they thought strategically or not is a different matter. We're dealing, I would say, today with a second class of people. And that's true, I'm unfortunately, for the entire Western world. It may well be true for China and Russia as well, by the way, that they don't have the same kind of people. What do you think made Scowcroft and his generation different from the people now? You probably don't necessarily agree with me, but the people now aren't as good as that generation. But what made his generation different?
Yes. Well, a couple things I'll say to that. One, you know, you did have the introduction of nuclear weapons that fundamentally transformed international politics. And so I think thinking through the implications of nuclear weapons for military affairs, for international politics, was one of these big shocks to the system that required creative and new thinking. And so it may be possible that artificial intelligence or some of the new disruptions we're faced with will lead to a new generation of creative thinkers to figure it out. Whereas, you know, once the great nuclear strategist had kind of figured out the implications of nuclear strategy, it may have been easier for those following in their footsteps in the 80s, 90s to rely on that received wisdom. But the second thing I'll say, and I think I do agree with you, is that my sense is that for national security advisor positions in the past, that presidents often selected for strategic thinking. I think that's why Scowcroft, Kissinger, Brzezinski, others, Walt Rostow, were selected for the position because they were seen as strategic thinkers. I'm sure that's still valued, but my sense is that there may be other characteristics that are more valued today, having a trusted staffer next to you. In an era of internet communication where things can leak to the press in an instant, having somebody by you who's been your staffer for years, who you trust, I think that makes sense. Cabinet officials are often also selected for reasons other than strategic thinking. Can they manage a big bureaucracy? It's a public relations job to some degree. Can they speak to the press? Can they lead a building? So I think you may be onto something, and I think that may be part of the issue, is that presidents now are selecting cabinet officials and national security advisors for things other than strategic thinking.
But you've suggested that I think the nuclear age required a certain degree of bipartisanship simply because it was an emergency situation. We don't have that emergency situation any longer. And do you see, when you were talking about revitalizing American security policy, strategic policy, do you actually see any hope of getting back a bipartisan consensus? Because from our point of view in Europe here, it is very alarming, but the Republicans seem to be objecting to every single thing that Biden actually does, except, of course, on Russia and China, but not necessarily for the right reasons, if you know what I mean. There doesn't seem to be this bipartisan understanding of where the United States is going or should actually go. It's much more negative than it was positive in the old days. Can you imagine getting detente through now? Now, I remember the days when Henry Kissinger was booed at the Republican convention in 1976 when he was introduced by Ford because of detente. By that stage, even the Republican Party was turning against its own president on something like detente. So from a European point of view, and I'm sure the same would go from a Japanese point of view or any other Asian or other allies of the United States, we're very concerned about the complete lack of bipartisan consensus now in the United, the positive bipartisan consensus. I don't mean a negative, but I mean a positive bipartisan consensus.
Yeah, well, I think the United States is polarized, and on certain issues, including transgender rights and things like that, very polarized. When it comes to national security policy, I actually do think that there is still a broad bipartisan consensus on the most important issues, and I think that's not often reported because it doesn't make for as good a story as the differences and how it was often reported that Trump was throwing all of Obama's policies out the window. Now it's being reported that Biden is doing the exact opposite of Trump, praising allies when Trump criticized them. So I think those make for good stories, but I think if you look underneath the headlines, there actually still is quite a bit of consensus. So just a few examples, despite the rhetoric, I would argue that Trump's policy was more mainstream than many people appreciated. To just take one example, he spent time rhetorically criticizing allies and criticizing NATO, but his administration actually spent more on increased spending on NATO. He praised Putin rhetorically, but his administration put in place new missile defenses, built new nuclear weapons to deal with the threat posed by Putin. So I'd say beneath the chaos and the headlines, there was a lot more.
But that was the only pushback by the Republican Party, wasn't it, against him on Russia?
On his foreign policy? Or
No, generally. From our point of view, we would say the only pushback by the Republican Party against their own president was on Russia. And also within the administration, which I understand you're actually saying.
I guess it depends on what you mean by pushback. I think there, the rhetorical criticism of allies, I think that many Republicans in Congress and the Senate disapproved of. I know within the administration, many of his officials disapproved of that. Yes, I hadn't thought about it that way before, but I do think that, they didn't, like pulling out of the Iran deal. I think there was a lot of support for that in the Republican Party. So that's not something that there was pushback on.
Well, we got a number of questions coming in, Matt, but I'm going to end my personal interrogation, if we can call it that, with the questions that I actually said I was going to end with, which is, if Vladimir Putin was listening to your presentation today, or Xi Jinping, what would they critique about him? What would they say you had got wrong about them? If you feel the whole point about strategy is trying to get it right in the sense of being able to cooperate with people rather than end up with confrontation. Though confrontation is sometimes inevitable, of course, and one can come to that conclusion easily enough and rightly enough in certain circumstances. So what would their main critique be of your presentation today?
Well, I think they might say three things. First, I think they would not be surprised. I think they'd say we've seen this before, U.S. leadership, U.S. exceptionalism, promoting U.S. alliances in our backyard, promoting democracy. So I think they wouldn't be surprised. But second, I think they would not like the strategy. And I think they've been pretty clear about that, especially the idea of U.S. alliances in their own backyard. The Russians and the Chinese have been very clear that they see these as legacies of the Cold War. That they want to see the U.S. alliance networks in their backyard disappear, and that they would like to establish spheres of influence in those regions. So I think that they wouldn't like this strategy. And I think they would say I've got wrong that I think the United States is, I think they would say I'm being overly optimistic in terms of what the United States can accomplish. But I think they're wrong on that. And I think this is dangerous. I think the Chinese do think that the United States is in decline. That this is China's moment, that China can get away with a more muscular approach in foreign policy. And so I'm afraid that this could lead to a miscalculation in a place like Taiwan, where China's own self-assessment of its strength and resolve and American strength and resolve is misaligned. The third thing I guess I would say to what are they saying is that I think they should like this strategy, even though they won't, because I think China benefited quite a bit in the 90s and the 2000s by being a part of this rules-based system. And I think this more aggressive approach of challenging it is not going to turn out well for Beijing.
Thank you very much. Right. Well, let's open it up. And you mentioned, Matt, just now Taiwan. There is a question on Taiwan. What is the United States going to do about it? And I see that the Chinese military think that by 2024 they will have a possible window of opportunity to attack Taiwan. And I think the American military think it's 2028, where we can split the difference. But anyway, the clock is ticking. And that's why The Economist said a couple of weeks ago, Taiwan is the most dangerous place in the world. So the question, I think, is what's the United States going to do by Taiwan? What does it think its allies are going to do in helping it with Taiwan? And where do we go from here?
So I agree with The Economist that Taiwan is the most dangerous place on Earth. It's the, you know, China has a number of border disputes, including with India, Bhutan, Japan. But India and Bhutan aren't formal U.S. Treaty allies. I think Japan, South Korea, Australia, the treaty allies are defensible. I think Taiwan is the place where the military balance is most uncertain. And the U.S. commitment there is ambiguous. You know, unlike with the formal treaty allies, the United States doesn't have a clear commitment to defend Taiwan. So what I worry most about is China miscalculating, China thinking that it can get away with attacking Taiwan, that perhaps the United States won't get involved. And that they can successfully reincorporate Taiwan militarily, when in fact that's not the case, that the United States would get involved and it would be a major conflict. So I think the best thing the United States can do is to help Beijing not to miscalculate, make it very clear to Beijing that if they attack Taiwan, that it would result in a major war, a war that China would likely lose. And so therefore, they're better off trying other means of their longstanding. I don't think they're going to give up on their longstanding goal of reincorporating Taiwan, but I think we can at least convince them not to go to war over it. And so I think that means clarifying the U.S. commitment to Taiwan, trying to get our allies to help clarify a commitment to Taiwan. And I have been encouraged by some statements recently by the Japanese, by the G7 communique. Not as strong as I would have liked, but these allies voicing a rhetorical commitment to peace and stability in the Taiwan Straits, perhaps helping Beijing to understand that a war with Taiwan could rupture its relations with the rest of the democratic world. But I think there's a lot of work to be done on the capabilities side. And so I think Taiwan needs to do more for its own self-defense. I think the United States can help Taiwan with its self-defense, including with anti-ship missiles, become a porcupine that's difficult for China to attack. But also, I think the United States needs to strengthen its capabilities, including with more long-range conventional strike capabilities. Michelle Flournoy, who long expected would be our next Secretary of Defense, may still be our next Secretary of Defense, put it well that basically the United States needs the ability to sink the Chinese Navy in 72 hours to prevent an amphibious invasion. And I think with some of the moves we're making, including developing conventional ground-launched intermediate-range missiles, submarines, and other things, that we are moving in that direction too slowly, in my view. But I think we can get there and make it clear to China that a war against Taiwan is not in Beijing's interest.
Thank you. We have a question about the Belt and Road Initiative, specifically about Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka, of course, has now got a huge debt that it owes to China because of a port that it foolishly agreed to build under the previous administration. It's actually a bigger problem on the BRI. What is wrong with the Belt and Road Initiative? Why does the United States dislike the Belt and Road Initiative? There are 75 countries have signed up to it, including a couple of European countries. Italy is, of course, one. This goes back to my larger question about why the United States doesn't want to share with China. But anyway, that's not the question of the questioner. The questioner, I think, was talking about debt entrapment and different ways in which China can advance its position in the world in more subtle economic ways, perhaps, than we've actually seen in the past when a great power has been pushing forward with its interests. Anyway, generally on the Belt and Road Initiative, where do you stand on that?
Yes. Well, I think there are some benefits of the Belt and Road Initiative. There is a great demand for infrastructure in Asia, roads, bridges, ports. And so those do need to be supplied. But the concern with Belt and Road is there are multiple concerns. So one is that this comes with strings attached, that China is often using these infrastructure investments to gain influence and to coerce the recipients. And I think Sri Lanka is a good example of this. And in the before times, back when we used to be able to travel, I went to Sri Lanka just a couple of years ago and actually saw this famous port that was being built by the Chinese. And Sri Lanka couldn't make the debt payments on the port. And so China moved in and seized the port. So I just think that countries should be eyes wide open about what some of the consequences are of becoming too economically dependent on China. We've seen that China is willing to use its economic influence for coercive purposes in other areas. And they've done this against the Australians. They've done this against South Korea, against Sri Lanka. And so some countries are beginning to realize this. The Malaysians have rethought a Belt and Road investment for this precise reason. So that's one concern, that it comes with strings attached. Two is the standards that China employs with these projects, which are different from the standards that we generally require in the developed world as it comes to environment, anti-corruption, and other things. You know, often the Chinese are coming in with bags of cash for leaders, and so they're making it in their interest, using corrupt practices, essentially. And so as a response, one of the things the United States has developed is this so-called Blue Dot Network, working with allies to try to incentivize Western private sector infrastructure investment in these countries. So at least countries have a choice. It used to be that China was the only game in town. If they wanted roads, ports, and bridges, they had to turn to China and accept the economic coercion and the corrupt practices. But we need to offer an alternative, and I think something like the Blue Dot Network could work. I know the Estonians have a concept they call trusted connectivity that they're very interested in. So I think the free world working together, incentivizing the private sector, needs to offer an alternative to China's corrupt infrastructure investments.
And here's a question on the United Nations and particularly the UN Security Council, of course, in which China and the United States are the two most prominent members. Is there any future for the UN Security Council in trying to mediate relations between the two great powers, or is it something that is kind of yesterday's news?
Well, I think both. So I think the UN Security Council and these kind of inclusive post-World War II institutions still have a role to play. I think there do need to be fora where the United States, Britain, France, the autocratic great powers, Russia and China, can get together and have discussions. But I think realistically, when it comes to global governance, the UN Security Council and some of these post-war UN institutions have severe deficiencies, which is that, you know, the UN Security Council requires the United States and China to agree. I think there are going to be very few important international security issues where the United States and China are going to agree in the near term. So in the strategy paper I mentioned before, present at the recreation for revitalizing, adapting, and defending a rules-based system, one of the things we argue is that we need to think about what are the new institutions that we need. We're not stuck with legacy institutions. We can also create new ones. And I do think institutions that bring some of the leading democratic powers together make sense. Again, something like a D10. Maybe China won't agree, but if the United States, Britain, France, Italy, Germany, Japan, South Korea, Australia, Canada, who did I leave out, can all agree on something, see a challenge similarly, see the approach similarly, are willing to support that, then I think that can be an effective way of dealing with problems, but also of gaining international legitimacy. And so I have a project at the Atlantic Council now thinking about what are some of these new institutions, if we were designing the international system today, that we would want to create. And I think something like a D10, a small steering group of leading democracies, would be a multilateral fora that might be more effective in the near term than something like the Security Council.
Then aren't you predicating a world which was divided into two, a Sino-centric world and a US-centric world? The D10 would be obviously US-centric. And the Chinese, you mentioned wolf diplomacy, but I see that Xi Jinping a week ago said, now we've learned our mistakes and we need friends. So he's on a friend initiative at the moment to be a little bit more popular with countries than China has been in the last couple of months. So is that a good thing? I mean, when we're dealing with climate change and we're dealing with pandemics and we're dealing with other enormous global challenges that we haven't actually seen as part of the diplomatic agenda before internationally, is this the kind of world that we actually want, which splits or bifurcates into two centers?
A couple of responses to that. One, I think the world is increasingly split, and it's, again, not due to the preference of the United States and its allies. I think the United States and its allies would have liked to have seen China integrate more cooperatively into this system. So I think it's China that's pushing back in a lot of these areas and creating these splits. So we should ask our Chinese colleagues the same question. But I'd say given these challenges, then the question's not either or, it should be both and. So I think it is correct that we should try engagement with China to deal with some of these issues, and China's involvement is going to be necessary to deal with climate change and pandemics. They haven't been cooperative on these issues. You know, China's bad behavior is one of the things that made COVID-19 worse than it needed to be. And when it comes to climate change, China's pretty good at positioning itself as a leader, but it's actually the number one greenhouse gas emitter. It's building over 100 new coal-fired power plants around the world. And so China is really this real problem that needs to be addressed if we're going to get climate change under control. So yes, China needs to be part of the solution, even though it's difficult. And so we should try to engage with them. On the other hand, does that mean that international cooperation, multilateralism becomes lowest common denominator, that if China doesn't agree, nothing gets done? I think that doesn't make sense either. And so I think that's why it makes sense to have a separate track of like-minded countries to engage in deeper cooperation. And I think there are a number of practical ways that can be done, setting standards for new technology. For example, if the US, EU, and Japan come together and set those standards, I think they can become global standards. Setting standards for how to deal with unfair trade practices by China and others. Again, if the US, EU, and Japan, three major economic powers that have complained about China's unfair trade practices that have similar ideas for how to challenge it, address it. If we come together and agree to a common approach with China's unfair trade practices, I think we can be successful. So I'd say it's not either or, it's both and. Try the engagement with China, but also pursue deeper cooperation with like-minded partners.
There's a question which is essentially related to what you just discussed, which is freedom. When China talks about championing freedom and when the United States talks about championing freedom, who are you to believe if you are in the middle here? What we might call the non-aligned world, for example, during the Cold War period. And of course, the argument the Chinese make against the United States is that you're championing a version of capitalism which leads to huge inequalities, that they're trying to be championing a Confucian model of capitalism. I mean, we can be very skeptical about all this, but this is the argument that is being put forward. We're offering an alternative to this Western idea that has predominated for 200 years, which are basically is not essentially a world of freedom or economic opportunity, but of capital, of greed. Let's use the word greed. I mean, the Chinese do use that all the time. Now, you and I may be very skeptical about this, but how are you going to convince African governments and other governments that have entered into these agreements with China and that actually believe that China is offering a non-Western alternative to 200 years of Western predominance in the international system? Everything that they associate with that, from slavery to imperialism and everything else. Because I think that's a much greater challenge than the Soviet Union ever offered, in a sense, because it's a cultural challenge, whereas the Soviet Union was an ideological challenge within a Western ideological system. Marxism was Western. This is a cultural challenge. How does the United States answer that question?
Yes, I'd say a few things. One, I think that democracy and capitalism aren't just Western cultural institutions. I think they've shown that they can flourish elsewhere. South Korea, Taiwan, Japan, many other countries have succeeded using open markets and free politics. And so I think it is a model that can work everywhere, not just in the West. Second, if the non-aligned movement is unsure about what a closer relationship with Russia and China might look like, I'd encourage them to ask Russia and China's neighbors. Go to the Estonians, go to Taiwan, and ask them. You know Russia and China well. Do you want to be part of a Russian and Chinese led system or a U.S. led system? And I think they'll get a good answer. Ask the people who know those countries the best. And it's interesting, non-aligned movement, you know, of course, historically, one of the leaders of the non-aligned movement was India. And I think India is making its choice. We see that it's also concerned about China working more closely with the United States and other democracies in Asia and this so-called Quad network, Japan, Australia, the United States, and India working together more closely against China. Is this a capitalist model? Is it about greed? Maybe some could put it that way, but I think there are a few people on earth who don't want a higher standard of living for themselves, who don't want a higher standard of living for their children. And so the question is, if that's what you want, what is the best way to organize yourselves to get there? And I think this model of open markets and politics has proven successful over the centuries. And the verdict is still out on the Chinese state capitalist model. There's actually quite a bit of evidence that these capitalist state-run economies don't work very well. And I think it's oftentimes dictators or would-be dictators who champion the China model because they like the idea that they can promise prosperity, whether it's true or not, and still cling on to power. And so that's what I would tell the people in these countries. Your leaders like this China model because they like the corruption. They like that they get to have facial recognition technology still maintain firm control, but it's false hope. If you really want prosperity, look at what Taiwan and countries like that have done to become wealthy nations.
And perhaps the last question, because unfortunately time is against us, but is a very central one. It's the one that keeps Henry Kissinger awake at night, if anything keeps Henry Kissinger awake at night, and that is the fear of a Russia-China alliance. And it's a fear which has been voiced by President Macron a couple of weeks ago. How can we stop Russia, pushing Russia into the arms of China? And at the moment, I think you have what Dmitry Trenin at Carnegie Center in Moscow calls an entente between the two countries, but not yet an alliance. Partly, I suspect, because the Chinese don't do alliances or don't really want alliances. They do partnerships on a very selective basis. And partly, perhaps, for reasons you will touch upon in a second about why it's difficult for Russia and China to actually have an alliance. But isn't that the geopolitical challenge? And isn't that the real difficulty we have with Crimea and what's happening in Ukraine? That everything, that every time the Russians do something, we are pushing back more and more into the arms of China. And is there any way of stopping that? Is there any way in which we can have a more productive relationship with Russia, which I think Macron was hinting at, and perhaps is something that President Biden is also thinking about in his meeting with President Putin?
Well, it is the case that Russia and China are working more closely together, and that's concerning joint military exercises, joint weapons production, high-level meetings, Putin and Xi calling each other best friends. So that is concerning. On the other hand, I do think there are real limits as to how deep this partnership can go. Russia and China still fear each other. I know I have engaged in track 1.5 dialogues with Russian experts who justify part of their nuclear buildup as a response to China. And I think that's not just a justification, but a real concern. So they're still planning nuclear war against each other. You know, the United States and Britain, a real alliance, we don't plan nuclear war against each other. So I think there are real limits as to how close this partnership can go. I talk about in my book, Russia fights almost as many wars against its allies as alongside them. If you look historically, it's fought with Nazi Germany, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, China. In recent years, it invaded Georgia and Ukraine when they were part of the Commonwealth of Independent States. So I think even if China and Russia signed an alliance tomorrow, there's still a chance they could go to war with each other by the weekend. That said, this is concerning. And even if there's not formal coordination, if, say, the United States got into a major war with China over Taiwan, would Russia see an opportunity in Eastern Europe? I think it would, and vice versa. If the United States, NATO, and Russia get into a war in the Baltic states, does China see this as its opportunity in Taiwan? And so I think the United States and its allies collectively need to plan to deter both countries at the same time. And I'm not sure we're quite there yet, but I think that will be an important part of the overall strategy, which I do think China is the priority. It's the more significant threat. So I think we need to manage Russia as part of an overall strategy that prioritizes China.
Yes, and I was reading an article recently about how the worst thing is the Nazi-Soviet pact, or the equivalent, which enables China and the United States to essentially go for it, with the Russians being basically the Soviet Union in 1941. Urging both sides on, and I actually in the book you know about by Peter Singer and August Cold, Ghost Fleet. It starts in space, I think, a space station with the Russians and Chinese against the United States. So anyway, there's all to play for, and unfortunately, we've reached the time we have to come to an end with this discussion. Matt, I'd like to thank you a great deal for coming along today and sharing your thoughts. And we've got a lot, I said food for thought, we have a lot of food for thought. So thank you so much, and for dealing also with the questions. I hope they weren't too aggressive. But I hope they were constructive. Thank you a lot. And I would just say to everyone else out there that we will be back online in October with another talk. So please follow our online website here. Thank you very much, Matt. And I will say goodbye now to the audience. Goodbye.
Thank you, Professor Coker.